places.
Attention, attention. You are listening to a pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. Curious Realm is busy traveling the vast void of time and space to find the best paradigm-changing content the universe has to offer. Enjoy the following transmission, and remember, stay curious. Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome back. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Reverend Michael J.S. Carter. We will be discussing the world of the experiencer, whether it's paranormal, UFOs, UAPs, the miraculous even. Experiencers have their life changed in a different way, and experiences become truths. It's interesting the way that these things transform us. Welcome back to the show, Michael Carter. How are you doing?
Brother, it's always a pleasure. I'm doing great.
I love having you on, and I truly love having you on for things more than UFOs. I mean, of course, yes. You're famous for your appearances in Ancient Aliens, things like that, and more than well-versed when it comes to UFOs, UAPs in the Bible, things like that. And that's some of what we talked with you about last time we had you on.
Yes.
Was UFOs in the Bible and how those events changed the people in the Bible.
Yes. Yes. Because I think that's, and you said it, and I'm glad you said it. You know, I talk a lot about, you know, what we're talking about, the paranormal and ufology and what have you. I remember reading and hearing a story about a therapist I knew who had a life-changing experience jogging before dawn in San Francisco. And he said he was just jogging along and the breathing and what have you.
Oh, no.
He was the car. He was everything around him. And, you know, that was his eureka moment. And, he said he didn't know how long it lasted for. My point is A, that it doesn't have to be an OBE, NDE, a contact experience.
Yeah.
You know, and B, it changed his life. It changed the way he walked through the world. It changed his whole Weltanschauung. And that's when you know that the experience is the real McCoy, as it were, because it the word transformation, you are transformed. You are different than you were the day before, and you start walking a different path. And so I think that's really important because we go for the sensational.
And that
sells, and that's true. But, you know, I mean, look, if you look at the Hindus and the Mahabharata, if you look at the Kama Sutra, you can have an orgasm, man, and have this spiritual experience that transforms your life.
Yeah.
So it's good that people are not always shooting for the big ticket, you know, the sensational, because it can change you.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, number one, especially in our modern society, we are sold the sensational.
Yes.
Every show is the sensational. Even right now, there is, if amongst the UFO UAP community, there is a large kerfuffle going on with, the whole concept of the secret space program and Corey Good coming out and saying, like, I made all this up. And there are people whose lives have been changed and altered because of the quote truths that he said, that he now says are his intellectual property. They are his spiritual guides, which, hey, if that's the case and they're your spiritual guides, cool. But the problem is now you have a bunch of people that have had a transformational experience in their life because of something that you said. And now you're calling them crazy.
So he made all that up, he said.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Like he's been found in an 8-hour long deposition, man. Like saying that, like, this is his intellectual property, that the blue avians are his meditation guides. If anybody else says that they've seen them or met them, they are delusional.
Wow.
And it's like, well, okay, then at what point do you stop selling them the delusion? You know,
yeah,
when this is a transformational experience for them.
It is. And, you know, I mean, we could always go down the rabbit hole of why the big turnaround. Did someone get to him? Mm. You know, of things. It's a transformational experience. And so, you know, these are how cults are formed. This is how, you know, things happen.
Yeah.
You know, you there's a spirit of discernment one happens to have. And, you know, I think, though, that in this phenomenon, and we see it in other disciplines, I guess, for lack of a better word, not disciplines, but other movements, other things like that. I have heard people tell stories. And somehow they just don't sound, it's just something funny about it. Mm. Now, I'm not going to tell anyone that what you said happened to you did not happen to you.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to say is that in this phenomenon, you get people on the fringe, and you get those people who are genuine. You get people who want to feel significant, who want to be part of a club, if you will. Well, and it's difficult to kind of discern and weed out. And so now he's taking these people along.
Yeah.
And now he's saying, well, we got that. Guess what? Psych. And
yeah. Well, it's
dangerous.
It can be.
It's just,
it can,
it can be.
And
but it's also, it's just painful for people.
Yeah. I think that's mainly what I'm getting to is that, the experiencer typically deals with some sort of trauma to begin with. Even if it is a suspension of disbelief, a shattering of the reality that you know to be, that in and of itself, the deconstruction of what you know to be real,
can be
earth-shaking to begin with.
Yes.
Like I think the first thing that comes to mind all the time is my religious experience that sent me to join the seminary. That when I spoke about it with my parish priest, he was like, "Chris, have you ever considered service? You may want to consider that." Because he didn't experience that. He didn't doubt my experience. He never. And what's funny is that I probably know a couple of collar wearing priests who would have doubted my experience.
Yes, of course.
Who would have definitely at least, you know, looked down on my experience.
Yeah.
And I experienced that later on in life too, going to my spiritual director with things that had happened to me, which was a lot of the reason why I kind of separated myself from the church itself. It was a large leap of logic for me to accept one and just say that the other's not there.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. Well, you know, we can accept it if it's in the pages of the Bible, but we can't accept it afterwards. It's like all revelation ceased after the book of Revelations. And obviously that's simply not true. So, you know, you see that. But yeah, it's a violation. I feel for those people.
Yes,
I did not know this piece of information because, you know, I don't know. It's
a rough one, and
we'll
it's a pretty new revelation within the community.
And how can he be trusted? Is this just disinformation? But more than that, I think it's just that that violation of trust.
Well, and that's why I brought it up, because once again, I've got a lot of books on my shelf from experiencers, even yours, from mm-hmm. your experience. And, you know, whether it's the experience itself, which can traumatize you, what you've gone through, or even the holding it inside, because nobody has the shared experience.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody,
mm-hmm.
who can you trust with that experience? Because you're literally bearing a part of your soul to somebody.
Yeah. Yes.
Transformatively. And are they ready for that? And are they willing to accept you for that?
Wow.
You know, and that's a hard barrier to cross emotionally. That's a big barrier of trust.
And that takes a lot of work to prepare. And also with what you told me, there's the commercial aspect, because now not only did I violate you, but I'm saying that something's wrong with you and I want money for it. Yeah. So it's all kinds of boundaries that have been crossed there. And I'm just sad to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, these experiences that whether they're paranormal, UFO, what have you, I guess technically they're all paranormal because they're outside of the norm.
The same room, the same umbrella, I believe.
But what was it for you that was the, I guess, catalyst moment where you realized that what you thought wasn't?
That's a great question. For me, it was when I got regressed, when Dr. Jean Mundy regressed me. Now, And her words were, the good news is that you're not crazy. You get to decide if it's the other part, if it's, since now that I'm telling you this is real. And, you know, that's when it became real for me, that I had a professional say, Michael, yeah, because, and that's what she dealt with people who were having experiences. Yeah. So, that was it. That was it. That was the trigger point for me. You used the phrase shattered reality. And so I was left to pick up the pieces. However, when that initial experience happened, I was already working towards, but, you know, my religion of origin, I was already reworking and experimenting and leaving the religion of my childhood. So I was already on a path, you know, Eastern philosophy, existential thought, metaphysics. So I was already on this path, and this expedited it for me, I think. So it took me, that was it. That was like the second layer of it. Yes, I know what I saw was real. When the book came out, my last book, Initiation, I talked to my at that time, my first wife, she remembered it. She said, I remember that night after I read your book. So I got the outside affirmation. But when I got regressed, and later Bud Hopkins regressed me, it made me that this is real. This is real, and now you're going to have to make some choices here. And those choices were what you said. I couldn't tell everybody. I got in a support group, but I was living with a secret, and that takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. To carry that. And then, you know, years later, I would tell someone and they would ridicule. So I was still, you know, I was hypervigilant. I mean, when I started writing my book, even when my first book was my master's thesis, Alien Scriptures, you know, I never said, I didn't put what happened to me. That was an addendum later on. I was just putting this out as research. Now, people in my support group knew, but yeah. So that was you know, it was a fragile time for me. It was really fragile. But luckily, the universe led me to people I could trust. My girlfriend, who became my first wife, Sandy, who was there initially, she was a deeply spiritual woman. Because, you know, a lot of relationships break up.
Oh, absolutely. Even lifelong friendships, families break up over it.
Yes.
Families break up.
Yeah, it's big. It's a big ticket item. So I was fortunate that way. But it was transformational because it changed my life. I was going in one direction as an actor. I was drugging and sexing and living a very fast life in New York. And right after that, it's like I stopped on a dime and I said, you know what? This is really not fulfilling me. And I took a detour.
Wow.
And use those skills.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah. So that's the transformational part, because you can have these experiences and not let them in.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you
pass them by like a stranger on the street.
Yeah. You can block it. And I get it, because it's fearful. It's all those things. And you don't, you know, if I acknowledge it, then I have to do something about it. If I ignore it, I don't.
Yeah. But there is I guess there is that cruel joke within it, like we used to play in the seminary of, I'm just educating your conscience. You know, well, now that you're aware, you're responsible for it.
Yes.
You know, and yeah, you know, it's that idea of, if you admit it, then now you've got to deal with the bearing of, what do I do with it? How do I process it? Everything else.
Well,
you could totally crush it down, ignore it.
It's with any new knowledge. It could be, whether it's religious, you know, theological, it's scientific. If I'm a tenured professor and I've been riding the train of Newtonian physics and the old physics, and I'm tenured and I've made my living, I'm comfortable, my family, and all of a sudden people are talking about UAPs and people walking through walls or poltergeist or whatever, you know, I put my bread and butter on this, man. I'm not sure I'm going to be so quick to embrace that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
and oddly, on the other side, we have the want of confirmation.
Yes.
And the like we were saying earlier, the almost rampant want of confirmation in our society right now, the rampant want of acceptance, of belief. And the fact of what I believe is right. And this proves that. And that takes us down polar opposite roads of extremism in so many fronts, from political to religious to.
Definitely. Listen, I have people in my church. I love them. You know, Unitarian Universalism is a very liberal tradition. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are dogmatic in their liberalism. And, you know, it's hard for them to see. But what they're doing is the same thing they're accusing more conservative brothers and sisters of. But they're blinded by it because they the need to be right.
Yeah. Yeah.
The need to be right. Yeah. The exact same thing on both sides.
Yeah.
So what was the teacher Jesus says? And so the blind lead the blind and they both fall into the ditch.
Yeah. Yeah. And at what point with your experience, Michael, did you come out to your family? At what point did you, you know, bring it up to your mother that this experience happened to you?
Well, my mom, okay, maybe we had a little bit of a head start. My mom was raised by her grandmother, and my grandmother was a psychic.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah. And people would come by the projects and say, they would rub my head and say, hey, tell your grandma she was right about that. Tell her, I'll get back to her. But, you know, like that. But my mom, I think, has had some type of experiences, but she doesn't talk about it. She's a very fearful person. But when I did bring it up to her. And she was very reticent, but she, you know, she didn't bite. She didn't ask more questions. It was almost like, yeah, okay. but she knows about it. My stepdad does not deal with it at all. We have our own problems, but he doesn't deal with it at all. My biological dad, who's since crossed over, one day he called me and he said, "I just saw you on a show." This was years ago before he died. He died of pancreatic cancer. And he said, what are you doing up there in New York, son? Is it something you want to talk to me about? I just saw you on a show talking about aliens." And so and I told him about it, and he never ridiculed it, but he never brought it up. So in some ways that was good for me because it, you know, they were on the fence and I got it. And but that was better than being ridiculed. I remember someone in my church was trying to get me fired because she saw me. She said I was up one night and I turned on Ancient Aliens, or she was flipping channels. The only show I was doing then was Ancient Aliens. Yeah. And she went to the church and went to the board. I mean, there was a big meeting and it was dramatic and, you know, not like the Inquisition, but it was like, come on. But they stood up for me. Good. They said, A, he's not preaching it from the pulpit. B, he's probably right. And C, we don't see it as a big deal. And then one other clergy person I talked to, I was in Boston going to an anti-racism conference that I was supposed to speak at. And she said, "Michael, I believe that you believe what you saw was real." She said, "But if you want to have a," and I'm not mentioning her name because she's still alive, and you know, and she said, "But if you want to have a career in this denomination, you must never tell that story again."
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, even to see that, like within the halls of the back halls of your own faith, you should be really reticent to share this experience.
But Christopher, let me tell you this. I did not tell people that I had the experience. I was having these experiences. But when I brought it to my advisor for my master's thesis, they approved it. I will always be grateful to Union Theological Seminary because not only did they accept it, my systematic theology, two of my systematic theology professors from different semesters asked me, would I stay on for a PhD? And I said, no, I didn't want to work that hard. And I didn't want to be my age now still being $70,000 in debt or whatever. But because they could have refused, remember, you know, it has to be okay.
Yeah, you can pose anything, you know, as long as it's a defendable thesis. But
they
could also be like, nah, sorry, man.
They could say you're not graduating with that tripe.
Yeah.
But they said, take the ball and run with it.
I'll
always be great. And that was Union Theological Seminary.
That's interesting.
In New York City.
Because
one of the top seminaries in the country.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. That is a huge name seminary.
They let me do it. And, we were being guided. Maybe some strings were being pulled invisibly. I don't know.
That's interesting because the Rice University Department of Theology. Department of Religious Studies, has actively started. This will be the second year. I'm really upset because it happens every year while I'm in Florida for this 2-week gig. For the second year in a row, they are having a symposium on UFOs and put on by the Department of Religious Studies. And they have actively started one of the first university founded UFO UAP archives. Complete with like works from Jacques Vallée and pieces of debris, everything.
And Rice University, I'm going to Google it.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. It's incredible, exciting. But it's really interesting to see that. Yeah. It's the religious studies department that is open-minded enough to consider this.
Well, at University of North Carolina, UNCA here, Asheville, University of North Carolina, Asheville, they have something called OLLI, I forget what it stands for, but it's adult education for people who are retired and what have you. And about 3 or 4 years ago, my schedule just hasn't allowed it. Someone asked me if I would teach a class on UFOs.
Wow.
You have to submit it and all that. It has to be approved. But there were enough people who were interested. It's just that I don't have the my cup runneth over with what's going on now.
Yeah.
So it's an idea whose time has come.
Yep.
And so these are exciting times that we, wow, Rice University. Whoa, who'd have thunk it?
I know, right? And when you're saying like major university, like they're up there, buddy.
Yes.
And I thought that was right from my hometown of Houston. I found out about that after it happened last year.
This is their second year.
This is their second year to be doing it. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty incredible. And like I said, a full
I'd like active to speak archive. There. I'd like to speak there.
Oh yeah, I guarantee you.
As a minister.
Yeah. It's incredible to see how these experiences have been literally changing the dialogue of our society over the last few years, mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. At one point, and whatever you think, this, we say it all the time on the show, whatever you think about the UFO UAP disclosure going on, the important thing is the dialogue has been opened.
Yeah.
And now there is an actual full-on reporting system. Used to be there was like kind of one over here in the Navy, just don't really report it, and everything else. Now there is a multi-departmental, like, okay, so a Navy pilot has something, here's the form to fill out. And it's multi-departmental. It's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, even on the civilian level, I mean, last week I may have sent it to you about in Newsweek about the UFO that was flying over near Ukraine or either in that nuclear facility there. It's not news in the sense of they've been monitoring our nuclear facilities and plants for so long. But I mean, it's just like mainstream news now. It's either, it's in the Washington Post. It's in, may not be a large article, but it's there. And that's the beginning. And once you do it, it does not, you can't turn, it's out there. You can't take it back. It's part of our culture now. All this conversation now about artificial intelligence and robots and along with the other stuff about wars and rumors of wars. But it's an exciting time. I say this is the year of the experiencer. I say 2023 is. It's like, an idea whose time has come. There's so many people I know who are experiencers that are getting together in podcasts and having little groups and, just supporting each other, people trying to write books or writing books, because that voice needs to be heard. Most of the people talking about our experiencers are not experiencers.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that because no. But we need to have a voice too.
Yeah.
We don't need people telling our stories for us. So I'm excited. I'm excited Same. About it. There's more diversity at these UFO conferences now. You're seeing people from different races and cultures saying, like, hey, I've had that experience. Mm. I see it, we're seeing it gradually for, right before COVID and there's more of an integrated audience who are attending and speaking. So it's exciting to me. And of course, it's glacial sometimes. Change can be, but it's happening and we're here to see it. Yeah. Your shows like this are putting the word out and empowering people to tell their stories. And I think that's what it's going to take. Little communities, if you will, for lack of a better word, banding together, doing podcasts, having speakers, writing books, lectures. That's how the consciousness is going to be changed. Because
Absolutely.
We can't just wait for the government because they're going to spin their narrative because they have other intentions. And that's okay. But we have to be in charge of our stories and have a narrative or counter narrative.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of like the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous was a beautiful idea. Once it became an accepted mainstream idea, it changed a lot of people and a lot of lives.
Yes.
That's really, I mean, even, and we've had the discussion before whenever you've been on about the support group that you found when you found it. And, the idea of nowadays being able to find an experience or support group, even knowing that MUFON has an experiencer resource team, where when you're an experiencer, like, you know, someone who's had contact in some way, things like that, like, it moves up to a different level, and they have a specialized team of people that come and talk to you, people like Sev Talk. You know, Kathleen Martin, the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, people like that, you know.
Yeah, there's something, you know, this, and when I was in therapy for unrelated stuff, I was in a 12-step program for codependency.
Sure.
And those 12 steps, I don't have to say, are very powerful.
Oh, they're beautiful.
It's a deep spirituality.
Changed my life.
Yeah. Mine too. That and a good therapist. But there's something, you know, and I was doing one-on-one therapy, Gestalt therapy, which I like, because it was working on emotions as well as, you know, the rational stuff, because you can rationalize anything. But we got, it unthawed me. I could feel, I could become more human. But the point I'm trying to make is when the therapist said, I have a little group of people who I think who have reached a certain point in their therapy, and it's time to go to the next level. And he said, I'd like you to be in that group. This was after a few years. And I said, yeah, even though I'm kind of like an individual person, I don't, but there's something, my point of all that is this, there's something healing about seeing another face across from you.
Yeah.
While you're telling your story. I think that's what makes the 12 steps possible and powerful. I think that's what makes, you know, this Gestalt therapy session, any type. But you get to, because people will mirror you. They will mirror back to you. And, you know, when you're a child and the child looks up in the mother's face, and what he or she sees in that face will stay with them. If she sees a mom who's struggling, maybe a single mom or a mom, you know, you can see the anxiety, you can read the fear, you absorb that. Or you can see the understanding, the compassion, and that sticks with you too. There's something healing about looking at someone else in the face while you're telling your story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And once again, to be able to share those stories now in communities where once like you were saying, it took a therapist that was open-minded enough for your experience to say, I think I know a group of people that you may be able to share with. And moving forward in technology from the world of chat rooms to the world of, you know, online groups and Discord servers and things like that now. Closed community chat groups, all kinds of things. It's really amazing to see how experiencers of all levels, from UFO abduction to paranormal, even targeted individuals, can find a community of people who've been through the same experience to be able to not only commiserate with, but be able to, I guess, really figure that out and what it means to their life.
Yeah. To
and
be
how
helped.
To process it.
Yes. To be, you know, in a safe space, very powerful, very important, and not to be ridiculed and to just be held, to know that there's these people, this energy that's lifting you up and that I'm with you. I'm not going to ridicule you. You can tell me anything and I'm going to, you know, it's like a 12-step group. People tell you, you may tell the sickest things or things you've done, and they come over to you and give you their phone numbers.
Yeah. Yeah.
most people run the other way. Boy, I got to get away from that energy.
Yeah.
But these folks are saying, Hey, Michael, here's my number, man. Give me a call. You need a sponsor. Give me a call. you know, and there's just, you can't beat that with a stick.
Yeah. And I think the really awesome thing to see right now is the cross empathy across society, the growth of empathy, the understanding of, well, maybe my uncle wasn't crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And maybe I'm not crazy.
Maybe I'm not crazy.
And so what we're talking about, you and I, and you are, a theologian. I mean, you know, what we're talking about is spiritual.
Oh, absolutely.
We're not talking about the lights in the sky, and that's intriguing. We're not talking about back engineering and, I mean, that's important. My mind doesn't work like that, but that's all important. But what we're talking about is the transformation that will help us, and is helping us engage with one another.
Yeah.
And for me, this is the crux of this phenomenon. It's not all there is. But for me, I want to know, because now that we, like we said earlier, what you going to do with it now? How are you going to walk in the world now? You know, I remember my friends who were in Vietnam, and they would come to, what you going to do when we get back to the world? You know, and I'm not likening the experience to a war. Mm. I'm just saying these people have had experiences. They've killed. They've been shot at. And now this is going to end. And now we're going back home. After we've seen and maybe done some things here, how are we going to react when we get back home? Well, it's the same thing. I've had an experience that I can't explain. Probably, I've been in contact with off-world intelligences, a whole different reality I've been opened up to. So how am I going to treat my neighbors the next day when I'm out and about? How am I going to look at life?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And
what does it mean for religion? What does it mean for what I believe and my place in it? That's what's crucial, I think, in the experiencer's life.
Absolutely. And how do you process that literal spiritual PTSD, the aftermath of because once again, and it's not even just the experiencer, but even the families of experiencers, the loved ones, you know, how do they learn to process their family's experience with an open heart and open mind?
Yeah. Yeah. Because they're just as changed.
Mm-hmm.
I know I still have a problem at night, sleep wise sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I probably always will. It's much better than it was. But yeah, my wife was out of town 2 weekends, and I was here by myself. My daughter was away, and it's tough sometimes because in my experience they could just pop up, they just show up. Usually I'm paralyzed, not all the time, but usually, and I'm usually alone, and even though I know they have not harmed me, some of these people look very bizarre.
Yeah.
And they're just in your house and you're like, my nervous system is trying to, I'm adrenaline, fight or flight. I can't fight. There's no flight because I can't.
Yeah.
Move. Yeah. So, and then they go and maybe I'll see them in a meditation or I'll feel them in the house and then I miss them, but there's a part of me that doesn't miss them. And that's been for 25 years.
What is it like for you to, because I mean, as a sleep paralysis sufferer and someone who has had his own experiences with that, I definitely know that constant kind of reticence and almost, there's almost a being awake while you're asleep. Like you're in a constant state of readiness to deal with it.
Yeah, I'm very vigilant. And see, for me, when they come to me, I'm not asleep. Maybe that would give me an out.
Wow.
As it were. I'm awake and I can't move. I see them. They see me. Sometimes they touch me. And it's always, not always, but it's usually don't be afraid, like the angels in the Bible.
Sure.
But, that's really easy for them to say.
Not a single person wasn't afraid.
Yeah.
Even Mary was afraid.
Yeah, come on, man. Look at you. You're green.
You just popped up out of nowhere.
Right.
How am I not supposed to be afraid?
Yeah, how can I not be afraid?
Yeah.
So, you know, and like I said, for me, it's that struggle of, and it's my own personal struggle. I'm not saying no one else has it.
No.
But I just have to say, you know, Michael, they've never hurt you. The one time they hurt me by mistake and I asked them to stop and they did. But, you know, it's just that struggle of, because people
did you get before? Their name?
Where are they from? I would have done this. I would have done that. And I know sometimes they can put you in a state to calm you down and you can dialogue. I have not had that.
Yeah.
I wish they would. Yeah, calm me down. Look at me, calm me down, and we can talk like this. But that has not happened.
Have you had it in your experience where they have harmed you, where they didn't listen
What had happened? At the very beginnings, when they came, the little grayish white people, I was frozen. I was paralyzed. And what they did was they put they showed me in my third eye here a syringe. And
oh, wow.
They stuck it. The hollow part right here in the back of your head where your neck meets that, you know, it's a little.
Yeah. The base of your skull.
They put a needle there. And I got to tell you, that needle hurt so bad that I screamed and the paralysis was gone. It's like I wasn't paralyzed anymore. And I was so scared. And I was screaming at the top of my lungs. And I remember Sandy, a friend of mine, an astrologer friend, told me, you know, Michael, this is going to sound weird, and I know you're not sleeping, and you got to talk to them. Even when you don't see them, they're probably in your room. They can hear you, and you got to set some freaking boundaries, you know, because you look a mess. And I did. I was drinking. I had dark circles. I wasn't sleeping.
Yeah.
Because they were coming twice a month.
Wow.
For like 8 months, almost a year. To make a long story short, she said, you've got to do it. So I went home. And I remember I felt stupid because I was like, is this really happening? And I was in my underwear. And I was screaming up at the ceiling. Okay, and I was in this.
You listen here now.
They tell you to get in touch with your feelings, and I'm like, you MFs, you got to stop. Do you know how bad that hurt?
What the?
And my girlfriend came in, Sandy, who was there the initial one, December 28, 1989, and she said, Michael, I can laugh about it now. She said, I didn't know whether you were high or what. She said, but you were standing in the middle of our apartment in your underwear, shaking your fist up at the ceiling when I walked in the door. So they were coming on new moon and full moon. So it's twice a month. Mm. The next time they came, and they would always come when she was gone, except for that first time, because she worked at night. And they showed me a syringe. And I'm like, oh God. And I felt, you know how you go get blood taken and the nurse is so great, he or she, it's like you don't even.
Yeah.
And they just take it. I felt a little pinprick in the top of my head. Now, call it wishful thinking, but I felt that they hurt me because it just didn't hurt. Now, it could have been just me, but you know, the last time it just felt like it was like, here, boom.
Yeah.
This time it was just so gentle. I don't know what they were doing, probably opening me up a little bit. Here's your crown. And someone said back here, you can get to a pituitary gland. I don't know, but I know that. But yeah, I felt like I was listened to. That was the only time I've ever had a problem, because nothing came up when Bud regressed me about that, about being heard or probed or whatever.
Yeah.
Or Gene Mundy. So I figured they listened. And that help me out, you know, that, okay, this is, there is some type of thing. And I wound up talking to myself much later, because they were coming on and off for years, the different races I've told you about. Mm-hmm. Then I had that healing in 2019 from the blonde blue eyed brother. And I just looked at my life, and someone said to me, Michael, look at your life. And my life was just better, my spiritual life. And so I could never say, and this doesn't mean that people who had, you know, bad experiences, probes, anal probes, I'm not saying that didn't happen. But for me, my inner life, my spirituality had deepened from it.
Yes.
And so it wasn't so. And what they did, they made me look at. They didn't say, you better look at it. But I came around to looking at other areas in my life where I let fear of difference, just plain old adulterated fear keep me from doing the things I wanted to do in my life. Because, yes, they were bizarre looking. And, yes, but I'm scared. And part of that's natural. But I didn't want it to block me from trying to have a relationship.
Yeah.
With them. But I just have a problem at night. When I'm here alone, I have a problem going to sleep. I keep the lights on like a little kid. I talk to other experiences. I leave that light on until the last minute, as if the light.
I quick step more than once as a grown man. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, brother. It's not for the faint.
To admit it.
You know, and I'll be 66 this year, and I have that. That's a little post-traumatic thing, and I just deal with it. I go to sleep.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just especially but I wake up during the hours when they visit. Like I go to the gym at 5:30, 3 days a week to swim. It's crowded. It's not. Yeah. People, there are other people up, too. But I notice that after many, many years, I start, and they would come between 1, 2, and 4. Sometimes 4 or 5 o'clock, but usually between 1 and 4, I would get my visits. And now I just automatically get up that time. People go, last night I got 5 hours sleep. I got up this morning. I didn't go to the gym. I worked out here. I did some yoga. I got an exercise bike. But part of that physiological thing is I can do that for maybe 2-3 weeks. I try not to, but I can get by on less sleep. I have more energy.
Yeah.
Hair, hair grows fast, skin and nails. I cut my hair. I still got my ponytail, but that was from them. But here we are years later, and I can still get by on less sleep than the average person for a little while.
Yeah.
For a little while.
Yeah.
But before I couldn't, because I was
overwrought with the lack of sleep.
I was traumatized. Well, listen, there's a reason why they do that. You know, the Geneva Convention says,
it will break you. It will break you.
Yeah. Lack of sleep, man. Even if you didn't do it. Okay, I did it. I'll tell you I did it. Yeah, anything. Just let me get some sleep, man.
Come on. Yeah. You know, with that happening to you passively, like you said, as you sleep, as you're awake, things like that. What is it like for you to have these experiences while actively meditating? Because that's a point of like you are not that you aren't spiritually active all the time, you know, but it's a different point, you know.
Let me be clear. No, let me be clear. I don't have the intensity. What happens is I'll be meditating and going through my candle and counting my breaths, and their face will be there.
Mm.
That's what I mean. Not that they come in while I'm meditating.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
They just pop in.
They pop in and they stay there. I remember. They
just rent your spare space for a minute.
Yeah, that's And I remember opening my eyes and doing that and closing them at the end, and they were still there. That's what I mean.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that shakes you up, man. I got to tell you, when I got healed by the blonde brother, the next day, I saw him, I saw them. And the next day when I meditated, I was on my sofa in my apartment and I closed my eyes. I was too lazy to come down and go in my other room and sit. And I closed my eyes and I was getting in that groove and they were both there. It was two of them. And they blinked their eyes like this. And I opened my eyes and I was like, oh, come on, stop. And I closed my eyes and they were still there. Wow. And I just said, thank you. I just said, thank you for what you did last night, because that blood clot, it was pretty big. And I the story. I had to go tell the doctors. Yeah. But yeah, I thanked them. So, and I felt that was their way of letting me know that, you saw me last night and now you see me again. And so you're cool. You're not crazy.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry. I thought that was my church.
No worries.
And I'm fortunate. My wife now, she's a therapist. she works with people with chemical dependencies and such.
Beautiful.
And she's a gem. And this is all new to her, but she has embraced it with open arms. I knew she embraced it when we were, where did we go? We went somewhere and she bought a t-shirt with a gray on it. I said, wow. I said, you
talk
really
about opening minds.
Yeah, she said, I said,
you're shaking
really
paradigms.
Yeah. And she's into it. She says, I don't understand it, but I am fascinated by it. And she says, she just supports me. I told her the other day, I'm going to be a little nervous. I'm going to miss you, but it's going to be a little rough. I'm not saying this to make you don't go with your family, but it gets a little rough. And this is a big house. But they came when I had a small apartment and whatever. And but I get to sleep eventually, but I'm up. I noticed that for some reason I forced myself to stay up a little later. Because I don't want to go to sleep.
Yeah.
And then, then you have to. I got to work the next day. But it's all good. I've been doing this since 1989.
What are the first steps that you give new experiencers? Whenever people come to you, Reverend, and are troubled by their first time, what's the first steps that you give them to accepting,
I guess? I tell them that, that first of all, that I will never ridicule you. I know what this can be like, so you are safe here. And that I tell them that the acceptance may not always be full acceptance, but it will come in time. And you need to talk about this to get it out. Those are the first things the first three things I tell them. And then we can go from there. I know you get this, Chris, hey, Chris, I need to talk to you, man. I got something.
Yeah.
I need to share something with you. I need to talk to you about something. And you may say two words and they may go on for a stream of consciousness for about 10, 12, 15 minutes. Oh, man, Chris, thanks, man. I needed that. Thanks for talking to me, man. I feel better. You hadn't said doodly.
Lick. Yeah.
It's something healing about being listened to.
Yeah.
About being taken seriously. And everything I'm talking about, you would do this if the person didn't have an experience. It's connecting on a deep level.
Yeah.
And that's the transformational part. That's the transformational part. But that's what I would tell them. And I would make sure, A, no one's going to hear about this. B, I will never make fun of you because I've been sitting where you're sitting. And tell me what's on your mind. Tell me what happened to the best of your ability. You are safe here. And once they feel that, gradually, it begins. And then we may talk about some meditations to do, or maybe saging the house a little more, putting a bubble of protection, wearing your rose quartz for your self-love. Some people, these upper chakras are open, they're so, they're draining. I'll suggest you want to be more grounded, ground yourself in your meditations, Feel yourself being supported by the earth. Get a grounding stone, obsidian, black tourmaline. We'll go at it from that way. But we're still going to talk about good old-fashioned psychology, and, you know, we're mixing it. That's the alchemy. Yeah. But that's how I would start with them. And, you know, because you got to get their nervous system. It's your nervous system that keeps you up when your wife goes away.
Yeah.
Because you're reliving. It's your nervous system that, I mean, I'm sure there are people who say, okay, let me talk to you, where you're from, whatever. But you're not in control of the narrative. That's if they want to do it, at least in my experience. But it's like someone pressed a button of adrenaline and it's stuck.
Yeah.
I'm stuck. Yeah. So I'm not, it's not stuck every weekend when she's not here, but I can start reliving that.
It can be hard not to surrender to the cortisol whenever it pops up.
That's the word, the cortisol.
You know?
Yeah.
Because, yeah. I find myself, especially a lot here lately, literally just waking up at like 1:30 and cannot get back to sleep until 5. Like my brain just races. Yeah. I will wake up.
And I know you're an empath, so you're probably picking up all this stuff, and don't let it be a full new moon or an eclipse or something. then you might as well just go outside and run outside and scream.
Yeah.
Right? Because I know you pick up all this stuff. So, yeah. So it's not always that. But, you know, you got to constantly cleanse. You got to constantly meditate, because the good thing is that you have it, that sensibility. But you also got to take care of it, because it can be overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you so much for your time, and especially your more than candid sharing today. So incredibly moving to hear you speak in such a way, such a candid way about your experiences and the way that they moved you, the way that they changed you, the way that they, the way that your family interacted with you.
They kind of keep a distance around that. I'll just say this, because I know our time's up. About a year ago, I was really, really tired. I was going through one of those times. I was by myself. It was right before we moved. And I did a podcast, and I have never done this. I was so tired, and I was so wrecked, not sleeping. Someone asked me to tell them the story. It was like I went right back there. I started crying on the air.
Wow.
I was like, wow, where is this coming from? Of course, she loved it. And you know, she wasn't callous. She said, that was so real. And I was like, why wouldn't it be? And she said, you know, I just wanted her to stop talking about it. She kept saying, I can't believe you did that. And it was so real. I was like, okay. But yeah, you know, it was like the button got stuck.
Yeah.
And she was kept probing and asking me. So da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, holy crap. But yeah, and you know, you can go right back there, man. You can go right back there.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it's imprint. That's how they get it out, because they know it's there. I'm talking about hypnotherapists. Everything is in lifetimes of stuff.
Yep.
And they know how to get it out. Well, they know how to, whatever comes up, comes up. So anyway, listen. Let's do it again as usual.
Absolutely.
I love that we just talk. It's unscripted. We just go for it.
Yeah. It's really fantastic. I love our conversations. And I really love the insight that you bring, not only as an experiencer, but as a minister as well. And how to, because this is ministry. It's outreach.
Well, this is your ministry. Remember we talk about
it. Oh, absolutely.
And you,
no doubt.
I'm comfortable with you because you are a minister.
You're
trained. And so I can say some stuff and you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And vice versa. You know, and so that kind of takes the edge off.
Well, I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah, it does help.
Before we let you go, of course, let everybody know where they can go other than our store to purchase your books, where they can go to keep up with all your work. Do you have any appearances coming up? I know that I know TV and everything literally lets you know, like, oh, hey, I know it's Wednesday, but tomorrow night you have an episode airing.
Right,
like,
right.
It's crazy what they do. It's hilarious.
That really fucked the last nerve. But let me answer. Okay, I'm going back out to Lake Houghton, ooh, Michigan, September 21st for their paranormal UFO conference. You can get my books on Amazon, Barnes and Nobles. My email is michaeljscarter@gmail.com. I have a Facebook fan page, Reverend Michael J. Carter. There's also another page, Reverend Michael J. S. Carter. You can go. I will answer any questions. I'll return your call. About 4 weeks ago, an episode that I shot last summer with Lawrence Fishburne and some other people on the Phoenix Lights. It aired on, it's called History's Greatest Mysteries. Yep. I didn't realize that Lawrence Fishburne is a UFO enthusiast.
Oh, yeah.
And they did something with, on the Phoenix Lights, Linda Katai. You know, she's kept this going.
She's great.
And I actually watched it. I usually don't watch myself on these shows, believe it or not. But my wife said, this is new to me. I want you to sit down with me and watch it. They did a wonderful job. It's season 4, episode 5. Phoenix
Light. Awesome. I have truly enjoyed what he has done with that series.
Yes.
I've loved it. It's been great. It's one of the shows that I look for every time I'm on the road.
Well, check it out.
I absolutely will. And thank you once again for your time. Please do hold the line while we close things out. Okay. While you are online checking out all the amazing work of Reverend Michael J.S. Carter. Of course, make sure to stop on by the Curious Realm store. That is one of the locations where you can buy his books. While you're there at CuriousRealm.com, you can also visit CuriousRealm.com/story. That is our experiencer page. If you're an experiencer of the paranormal, UFOs, UAPs, abduction, if you're a targeted individual, government whistleblower, feel free to stop on by, fill out our form. You can leave your evidence there, pictures, audio, video. We will present it to our experts whenever we have them on the show and try to get you some answers for your case. We also have our experiencer hotline, 512-298-3913. Feel free to call and leave us a voicemail of your experience, and we will share it with our guests on the show. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spigeric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7%. Off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7.
Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to our sponsors, True Hemp Science. I have been using their product for years now. Christopher Lynch is an absolutely amazing individual. Whenever I come back from my road work, we are looking at having him back here in the studio to talk about some of their new products. And of course, their spigeric process, this literal alchemical process of using every part of the plant. Absolutely amazing stuff. We just got done talking about healing and things like that with Michael J.S. Carter, and we always get into esoteric topics with him, and I thought a great follow-up for that would be Gretchen Cornwall, because she does a lot of work into the world of the Knights Templar. She is the author of The Secret Dossier of a Knight Templar of the Sangreal. We will be talking with her about some of her recent research that, I mean, while Michael J.S. Carter is on Ancient Aliens regularly as a talking head, as well as other programs, Gretchen is featured fairly regularly for her work into the Templars, especially Templars in America, on Oak Island. And her research goes into amazing places, especially churches, stonework, things like that. So welcome back to the show, Gretchen Cornwall. How have you been doing?
Oh, thank you. It's really nice to talk to you. I was completely jazzed when you messaged me and said, hey, do you have some time? And I, yeah, for you, absolutely.
Oh, I love it.
Christopher, absolutely. So I'm really happy to, one of those kismet moments. I had just finished three episodes on my YouTube channel about Templar carvings and alchemy and even Viking history in North America. And Had just completed a few days in Gloucester. I just felt so inspired by Gloucester. I went there and filmed on one day, six locations, that all had to do with this overarching umbrella topic. And because I was able to do all of that in one day, I had another spare day to go to Gloucester Cathedral. And that's when it all hit. I really just couldn't believe what I encountered. And what made it so special is Gloucester Cathedral allows the public up into the upper galleries. I've never been in another cathedral that allows that. And of course, that's where all the hidden carvings are, the green men are, and where real interesting research can happen. So Gloucester trusts their public to take care of themselves on these tight spiral staircases going up and down, and with a rope for a guardrail. So, and uneven steps, you know, people have been walking on these stairs for centuries. And the views up there are dizzying and the carvings are breathtaking. So I was truly able to walk and discover Templar carvings done by the Cistercian order. The Cistercians were first and developed into an international corporation, really, by Bernard de Clairvaux, who was a main mastermind behind the Knights Templar. And the Knights Templar are basically Cistercians with swords, and they have the same exact rule book, the same, you know, rule of order. So the Templars were gone, unfortunately, by the time this gallery was built. But because there were Cistercian abbeys in the area, they had their own stonemasons, I was able to determine that because of these carvings that the Templars would have recognized and used themselves, this was a Cistercian stonemason that had done work on Gloucester Cathedral and hidden carvings up in the gallery where worshipers would not have normally been given access to. And I go over that content in the episode 3 of my 3 YouTube videos, but I broke it down into 3 episodes because an hour and a half is a lot of time, you know, for somebody to hold their attention. So I thought I'll break it down into 3 sections. But the Cistercians continued their activities all the way up until Henry VIII, when he broke away from the Catholic Church so he could marry Anne Boleyn. Mm-hmm. And he basically looted all of the churches, the monasteries, and books were burned, properties were given to his favorites at court. So Gloucester Cathedral is lucky to have remnants from pre-Henry VIII time. I'm in awe, and I feel so inspired when I come across these lost carvings or statues or paintings. And they're usually going to be found in churches or abbeys because that's the only thing left. You know, I've discovered through that's it right there. That's the special one. I discovered it on the way out of the gallery at Gloucester Cathedral. Now, this is where things get tricky. You're never going to find a perfect smoking gun with hundreds of years in between.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about alchemy, see, today we're used to our world being standardized. There's no such thing as standardization in the medieval world. You'll find that in the written language with lack of punctuation. A lot of it was phonetic spelling. Some things were exact, but things got changed. And when you're talking about the art of alchemy, it was done to hide your activities from the competition and from even your patron.
Oh, because absolutely.
You know, if you were a powerful, rich nobleman, aristocrat, a ruler, you would have had somebody at court like John Dee, Leonardo da Vinci, you know, some very famous historical. There you go. This is a standardized alchemy chart.
As close as possible to, what would be one. And I mean, one of my, I guess, obsessions over COVID, Gretchen. I've been fascinated by alchemy my whole life. And it's pretty remarkable. Like, we are verging on alchemy right now. We have made gold in the lab. Like, it exists. We can change other elements to gold. So it's pretty remarkable. And that was, of course, one of the big quests of alchemy, was turning lead to gold. But if you start actively going through and reading alchemical texts, if you start reading the history of alchemy, things like that, it really is much more of a philosophic mystery school than it is a chemical process. There were things that were there, aquavit, things like that, that you used to free substances from their form, but this was all really analogy for changing yourself and purifying your own base metal of lead into gold. And how do you follow this process for yourself in life? That was really a part of the big mystery that they were hiding, was the fact that they were sharing this esoteric knowledge of reaching the divine without a church.
Yes.
As a mediator. And
that's one of the reasons they got in trouble, along with their wealth, which the King of France wanted.
Oh, yeah.
But the King of France couldn't go after the Cistercians.
No.
So they survived.
Yeah.
But they've also survived across Europe. There are two active Cistercian houses in England now. Wow. They were invited back. They resuscitated two historic buildings, but they are still active across Europe. And, you know, medieval Europe had this underground stream that flowed through the centuries that the church at the time could not extinguish, no matter how hard they tried. And if you had enough money to defend yourself, if you were a nobleman, then you could defend yourself against the church, although they were able to arrest some people. But by and large, they weren't going to go after somebody who had a large army.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They didn't go after people like the Medicis, who built entire churches, cathedrals, things like that. And those were the people who were the backers and patrons of people like Leonardo da Vinci.
Exactly, exactly. They knew what they were doing. And that's what drives me. You hit the nail on the head. Behind all the carvings, behind all of these massive stone edifices that we can still visit today, is this thought structure on how to turn the lead soul of a human being into golden light.
Yeah.
And that's what it's all about in truth. They also were working on other more pragmatic, because we still live in the physical. We have to learn how to balance the needs of the soul and the spirit with the needs of living in a physical body on earth. And it's not easy.
They were monks. They were monks first, warrior second.
Exactly. You know,
despite any esoteric study, things like that, they were they were drilled in their religious practice.
I agree. We are of like mind on all of this. They were at the top of their game when it came to metallurgy. Mm. And also on the cutting edge of sciences.
Yeah.
And they were able to organize and work with those in power with money. And when I first saw Corian Maule presenting on the Curse of Oak Island, and he graciously let me use his photographs. Unfortunately, the editors on Oak Island didn't really, they're not medieval nerds like you and I, Christopher.
Yeah.
They're trying to do a job really quickly every week, and it's a lot of pressure. But they didn't outline the four symbols carved into the stone properly, and it caused a bit of a brouhaha, in social media. So Corian came out and said, "Here are my of unhighlighted to highlighted," and it told a completely different story. And I realized that the symbols were all related to metallurgy.
Yeah.
So now the kicker is that they are also interchangeable. For exact, the first one, the circle with the cross on top, is a very famous symbol in the medieval era, meaning it's the global, Globus Cruciger, if I'm saying it right. It means God's, dominion on earth. God is in charge.
Basically like the orb that you typically see the figure of God holding.
Yes,
it is. In medieval art.
And the other meaning for that, when you're talking about the three-dimensional world, is it's copper. And of course, you're depending on the orientation of this thing. We don't know the original orientation of this stone. And I am confident that it is medieval. Anywhere from the late, 1000 something to the 1300s. I've looked at stone carvings and castles and cathedrals and graffiti marks for a very long time. And I'm confident in the dating of that. They were also keen to hide their metallurgy. Having a resource that can help fuel a day-to-day life, a war effort, self-defense effort is really crucial. And I think we're looking at symbols of hidden metallurgy and sources of wealth that the late Vikings into the Templars would have fueled their programs. And so we're looking at the symbol for copper. If you turn it upside
down. Also the symbol for Venus, which is a planet ruled by the metal copper.
Indeed. And I didn't really hit on that too hard in these, the three videos I've put out, but it is associated with Venus, who plays a large part in these mysteries with the Templars. Because Venus, the morning star, the evening star, appears to form horns on the horizon over that 24-hour period of time, the morning star, the evening star, it's considered, because it's an astronomy symbol at that point, a navigational issue as well as an alchemical issue of the forces, the divine forces that come through planetary bodies. And the medieval world, you would often see a man or a woman with the planets vertically aligned down the center of a human being. And that is the European model tree of life out of India, the Kabbalah and the Jewish Kabbalah. And the Kabbalah infused its way, into Europe. And so Europeans adopted these practices centuries ago. The Templars were aware of these practices because of their footprint in the Middle East. And the Europeans had their own way of expressing this in shamanistic practices prior to it being formalized into the Judaic stream. And of course, Christianity has a close relationship with Judaism. And later on, the Rosicrucians took the Christian cross and put roses on it. So, updating and making those things those processes of the electrical body of the human being explainable to Europeans in the terms of roses. Versus energy, the Sephira or the energy centers out of India.
Yeah.
So I didn't go heavy into all of that in my three videos. I stuck with what could be used and processed on the ground to help keep their projects moving forward. So the first symbol, is copper. And with its Venusian alchemical characteristics behind it. And what's interesting with the next one is that represents saltpeter. And that is important for producing gunpowder. And I have found European early examples of gunpowder experiments. They were experimenting with cannons with arrows fired by pouches of gunpowder behind it.
Yeah.
Now, in that image you're showing there, the next one over to the right, the third one in, it looks like it's got a pointed peak on it, but it's not. That's just how Corian drew it. If you look at the original image, which I haven't sent you, but it's available on my YouTube video, the original image is actually curved. And it's got a dot in the middle.
Yeah, that, I mean, it looks kind of triangular, but if you look at it, it really looks like a fat crescent.
Yeah, it's an arc. So that didn't really show up very well there. And it's got a dot in it. And that's how, the moon was represented, in alchemy. I didn't send you, I might have. There's a YouTube, there it is. There's a YouTube screenshot of myself with those symbols. Keep going. That's it. So you've got copper, saltpeter, and the image below, Luna, the moon, that's from a 15th century German hermetic alchemy text. Now, again, it's not exact, but we're talking about codes here, codes that could help you win a battle. So codes that if you tried to break or steal, you would have been killed for, because these are codes that a king wanted to use to give himself an edge on the battlefield. So this is guarded stuff that today, is highly, highly guarded material. You can't just walk into the Pentagon and take something. However, recently something like that did happen.
Ask that kid.
That's
the Discord champion.
Yeah, that's young man who's now going to end up in prison for, he should have found something else to focus on. But, if you go after stuff like this, you're going to get caught, by somebody trying to guard it who's bigger and badder than you are. So anyway, again, it's not exact, but then codes going back with alchemy were specific to that alchemists, especially a lead alchemist working in a lab that had apprentices. And he would have to decide which one of his apprentices, and it more than likely was a son, or an adopted son, that he would eventually give all of the keys to his kingdom, you know, once he really, you know, once he could be trusted as a human being and as a competent alchemist. So I do think that that symbol found on Oak Isle, you know, in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, on the beach there, was silver. So we've got copper, saltpeter, and silver, and then the image for verdigris. So the way I approached this, and a lot of people in social media are approaching this, you'd not believe the conversations that are going on about this right now online. Yeah. And I really have some sympathy for Corianne, who has had to weather this this storm of people weighing in, wanting to participate, tearing it apart, you know, throwing out their own theories.
The communities are brutal.
They are brutal. And I really feel for him. But the symbol, the last one represented in that lineup of four, and they're so close together as to be a sentence, if you will, or a completed thought. And that last one is an amalgamation. I have looked everywhere for it. Corianne's research partner, the very venerable and competent Christopher Eric Morford, has not been able to find an exact match. And I have put this in front of two doctors who are steeped in alchemy. They said, we don't know what it is. You're not going to find an exact match. And there are a couple of potentials that come close to it, but you have to go to ancient languages to get close to it, or go to alchemy. And because this is a practical matter of copper, saltpeter, and silver, I chose to go the alchemy route. So if you take the solar symbol, the circle with the cross in the middle, which is around the world,
yep,
that is in alchemy verdigris, which is a byproduct of copper. And what they would do in the Middle Ages, depending on how much money they had, if you were a lord with a stable, you could dig a cellar. And the animals in the stable, the horses, the cows, whatever, would pass water. And over time, the urine would interact with the cave, the cellar underneath, and form, form a very acidic product that if you were to put on top of copper plating, the copper plating would very quickly form a top thin layer of verdigris, which was used in paint. Because they only
pigments.
Had paints, pigments. They only had natural forms to create art with. But I found a reference that they used verdigris in the notches where you place a feather as a antifungal agent to keep little critters from munching on the feathers. Before, while you were stockpiling arrows before you went to war. That's huge.
Yeah.
So verdigris was used to protect feathers. And how many arrows do you think an army would need to launch an attack either in the Holy Land, you know, or at home to defend,
yeah.
You know, and it took a good 1 to 3 years to prepare
for an
event. So you don't want your feathers to be eaten by little critters while they're being stored.
Yeah.
But only a wealthy person could do that. Not everybody had that. We're not talking about standardization here.
Yeah.
We get so confused in the modern era about standardization. That didn't exist going back. Even, we're still in the process of standardization.
Standardization didn't exist until Henry Ford, man.
Thank you.
Perfect. It was like, we need a standardized process to create an assembly line for something. Then, things were artisan style. The dude making arrows right next to the other guy making arrows may have fletched them slightly differently.
Well, yeah, and if you didn't have the money, and a lot of armies were ad hoc.
Oh, yeah.
The king said, okay, to my baron, you promised to bring so many, men to war. And they might have had some of their inner courtiers who were capable of warfare. And warfare at the knightly level was expensive. You had to have a horse. You had to maintain the horses. You had to have your blacksmiths, you had to have armor, on and on and on. And a sword was a rich man's game. Often they would go into battle with axes and poles, and unfortunately the farmers were press ganged into following along, and those were the ones that were bantha fodder. Forgive me. Oh my God, I can't believe I just did that. That's
classy.
A Star Wars reference. Forgive
classy.
Me, cannon
Talk
fodder.
Talk about comfortability of a guest.
cannon fodder. But I do have a historical person that would be up for this particular job. So just to quickly explain the symbol,
yes, please.
Since we're continuing along this line. So you've got the verdigris symbol in the middle of a stave with arrows pointing towards the stave. It's eerily similar to the Cistercian cipher. And the Cistercian cipher was a vertical stave. And if you can find the photograph of myself, a screenshot where the number 4, 40, 400, and 4,000 is represented. There you go. So the Cistercian cipher in rough, you can see at the top right, that's for your single digits. On the other side, 40 is for your tens, and then below you've got your hundreds and your thousands. But this stave is a little bit wrong. That triangle on either end isn't alchemy because it's an open triangle. It's open. So that's kind of a problem. I've looked back into medieval alchemy with triangles, and they usually represent earth, air, fire, and water, or male and female principles, but they were always closed. Now, here we are talking about the flip side of standardization. So, again, I'm trying to go as much as I can with practicalities and with the process of metallurgy and treasure. And warfare. So I chose to run with this image found on the beach on Liverpool, Nova Scotia, as a hidden Cistercian cipher. So it should have been, those triangles should have been shoved closer in to the middle. And brought inwards. However. The other reason why I think that I'm correct on this is this, and I owe this, forgive me, that's the doorbell. the 4,444 represents the nautical miles to Jerusalem from Oak Island. And yes, they would have had the capacity to have known that at that time, which I go into greater detail in my second video, might have been my third. Anyway, the three videos cover a lot of ground, but I appreciate that my research friend noticed the nautical mile reference to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem in medieval maps is always depicted at the center of the world. And it wouldn't have been out of step for a Cistercian a Cistercian slash Templar, stonemason, you know, mining, to say, hey, okay, we're mining copper, developing saltpeter and silver, verdigris, processing, you know, verdigris, and we're going to use it in to support the King of Jerusalem. And our efforts over there, and we're going to use it to defend ourselves at home. And so it wouldn't be out of place to use Persian cipher. So that's what I think this is. And I explain myself at greater depth in the videos that I've just come out with. Because this is such a visual topic, I decided not to write about this, but to put it out into video format. And what shocked me was that Cistercian cipher in Gloucester Cathedral, up where nobody would have generally seen it. And the problem with that is it's on its side. It's presented horizontally instead of vertically. There are a couple of possibilities for that. They wanted to hide it. That's pretty much what I've got on that front. There it is. Now, that is incorrect if it's horizontal. But if it was a Cistercian stonemason and they chose that as their mark so that they could get paid for facing that stone, and it was potentially inserted horizontally instead of vertically, that's possible too. But you know, I'm erring on the side that this particular Cistercian wanted to hide what he was thinking. So It's so fascinating, you know, putting these all together. And I want to introduce to you someone named, his name is Sigurd the Crusader. He was the king of the Shetland Islands, the Orkney Islands, and Western Scotland on the coastlines. And he was kind of a pretty brutal guy. But he predated the Templars, if you will. He was the first king to go on crusade in support of the first monarch of Jerusalem. And he had 5,000 men, 60 ships, and he voyaged to there and in support of the Holy Land. Amazing individual. And he was a pretty rough fellow. But what happened is that he, because of his disciplinarian approach, he was able to usher in what is regarded as a renaissance of Norse culture. He was the king of Norway as well. So what fascinates me is Oak Island has a deep relationship with Scotland and with the Sinclairs that came along later in the 1300s. Yep. But he goes back to, he reigned, you know, he was born in 1089. And I believe he passed in 1130. And he was in action the same time frame as Bernard de Clairvaux. But here's the kicker. They've recently discovered that there was a Cistercian monastery in Norway. But the big discovery was and the Cistercians were there at the same time as the king of Norway, Sigurd, the Crusader. But they used to think that metallurgy and copper mining, a metallurgy of copper was not done there, that they would have had to have import copper. But they were smelting it. They found at that one location on Copper River that the Cistercians were smelting copper. But because of certain things that were happening in Europe over the centuries with the Black Death, with war, this or that, the knowledge of smelting, of deep tunnel mining came and went because people died. The people with knowledge died. Yeah. So, you know, if you were the king, you wanted to grab hold of those people, get them working for you, and leverage their skills. I think Sigurd the Crusader was in Oak Island and also might have been responsible. Someone in his pay was responsible for those markings on the beach there. Now, here's the big epic aha moment. Here's why. Now, we know the Norse were in Iceland. They were in Newfoundland. They just kept coming south along the coast. They traversed all the inner waterways. I'm very proud to be working with director Lucas Santoni on the series on Amazon Prime called The Templars. And I'm in episode 3, 4, and 5 and helping him writing the narration, etc. But we know that the and he interviewed a fantastic individual that was able to forgive me, there's so many things going on. We know the Vikings were there. The Vikings are a precursor. The Vikings flowed in to the Templars. And I know this, and I will follow this up with in-depth research as time goes on. But it's the same DNA, the same people, the same skill factor. But you take the Norse, and they would have gone down the coastline of Northeast America. There are whispers, anomalous artifacts there. But here's the main kicker. I believe fully and that they were penetrated into the Great Lakes.
Yep.
They built relay stations along the St. Lawrence River route. And that's where you get the New Ross Castle on Nova Scotia. There's actually a fortress depicted on the 1530 map done by Cartier near Saginaw River. You also get at the far end the Kensington Runestone, which I do believe is real. You get the site that I went into in Wisconsin on the reservation there. That's the subject of the Templar Quest in North America that I wrote. There is so much stonework, so many carvings that are not Native American. But there, are you aware of the copper mines in Lake Superior? It's an ancient location. Yeah. The Native Americans were digging these open mine pits going back. I still can't believe it myself, you know, 8,000 years ago, 7,000 years ago. And these pits range anywhere from 5 feet across and just as deep to 30 feet across. And they never developed tunneling. So they mined there for centuries, millennia, and they never developed metallurgy and they weren't smelting. What they did was they broke the copper veins loose from the matrix stone and pounded it into metal plates. South America was doing metallurgy. Now the majority portion of all that copper has not been found. There was an That's a mystery in itself. Then you get 1800 years where nobody was mining. There's not very much domestic waste because it was an encampment going with the weather scenario, because the weather gets terrible there, you know, the snow, everything. So that it's people came in, they mined, they left with their tools, they had temporary structures. So flash forward to at some point in around 1000 AD, people start mining again, but it's not the Native Americans. According to the Native Americans in that area and their lore, there were white men mining, and they were there up until 1320 when the mining ceased. And you have to ask yourself, where did that copper go? A Norse crucible was found on Baffin Island amidst anomalous architecture. And they discovered traces of brass and glass having been in this crucible, stone crucible, having been worked at with high heat. And the ratio of the brass was such that it was pinned onto the Norse. They found similar crucibles in Norway that equated to this crucible found in Baffin Island that had been prior thought was strictly Native indigenous peoples. So, you know, a picture is building up here. I think that Sigurd was potentially, there you go, that's it. He was the one that was mining. And, you know, these dates are fluid because it's really hard to get back to an exact date unless you've got a lot of archaeology information.
Yeah.
Oak Island is doing incredible work with their archaeology information and their dating. But unless you can find the objects en masse, it's really hard to pin down. So you have to rely upon anthropology, legends, objects, who had the motivation, who had the technology, the capacity, who had the very steep need to do these things.
Well, I've said it with you on the show. I've said it with family, friends, all kinds of things. Oh yeah, I've watched. Okay, they ain't finding nothing. Even acorns get a little tough nutted about it. They showed nothing this week. It's like, yeah, I guess you care nothing of science.
Exactly.
Actual science. And I'm sorry that they didn't find a trove of gold today.
I know.
However, the scientific data that they are pulling every week is phenomenal.
I know. Cut the guys some slack.
Enough to literally build a small museum.
Well, exactly. And they are doing that.
Yeah.
They have, you know, and I'm going to bring this full circle with you. I sent you some stones with carvings on it. And I'm going to take this full circle. And they discovered, that's it. That is the language of Futhark, which is an umbrella for Germanic runes, and because it's so badly eroded, they weren't able to decipher the meaning of this. And at some point, now this is a very high status stone, and it could have been used in many different ways inside a building. You know, this wasn't just done for the crack of it. This is a high status object. And somebody with skill. So here you have, for all intents and purposes, Norse language, Ogham, which is was in use up until about 1300. And that's such a key date. You know, that's nearing the demise of the Templar Order.
Yep.
Language is changing. The Cistercian cipher is falling out of use at this time. But this was found on Oak Island.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the last two episodes, but I understand that they have found objects that relate going back to the 5th century in situ, European.
Yeah.
So that just...
And look at that.
You know, Europe was
ruins stopped being used in Norway in the 1400s.
You know, the Norse are fierce, capable sailors. They had multiple navigation devices knowledge. They were, I hate to use this analogy, but as a science fiction fan, they were the Klingons.
Oh, absolutely.
Of the human world.
Yeah.
And they were good at it, but they brought civilization with them as well. You know, when peace, you know, in their own world, in their own kingdoms was established, the flowering culture was incredible. And humanity is pretty fierce. You know, I don't know of a single day around the world in human history that never had war. And I actually went out online to see if there was a kingdom that never went to war. And guess what? There isn't. And if you look at the Tibetan history, they invaded their southern neighbor 500 years ago. Unfortunately, humanity has this in them, but we also bring that desire for spiritual lift and embodiment of light, and we pine for it. So it's really a strange coin when you get that spiritual aspiration wedded to warfare. And you know, it's so important to be able to defend yourself, because somebody somewhere is going to want to come along and take all your toys.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough out there. It really is a tough old world. But I was so astonished to see that carving in the Tribune Gallery in Gloucester Cathedral. And I feel like I'm forgetting to mention something to you, but it's just been a wild ride. I also found in the upper gallery the Cross of Jerusalem, worn by Godfrey de Bouillon as an equilateral cross in the Middle Ages, contemporary, as well as being depicted by the Medicis, as you see in that mural on the left, with oranges or tangerines in his hair and a wreath, and the Cross of Jerusalem became expanded over a few hundred years period time.
Yeah.
So it was astonishing to find, and there are a couple other carvings I found too. I spent maybe 4 to 5 hours there photographing an amazing array of unusual graffiti marks that I look forward to sharing in the near future. But the one that I, related to Oak Island, I've shared with you here and in my three videos on YouTube. But it all hinges on that copper mining, and it's very possible that, you know, their seafaring vessels would have been moored on the coast, and then they would have taken their more shallowed vessels. They could have even traded with the Native Americans. They could have rented a boat, and also a Native American that wanted to be, you know, paid for taking them further through the waterways.
Yeah.
Not all experiences between Native Americans and Europeans were negative. They were trading. And I think they even figured out a way to get past the disease factor. the Native Americans were also fighting between each other. There were political problems between tribes. But what I think they ended up doing was developing a relay stations down the St. Lawrence River into the Great Lakes. And these little fortresses, whether they were wooden, whether they were stone, the Native Americans would go out and hunt because it was dangerous for the Europeans to do so, bring back the furs, trade with them. And this was a great open secret prior to Columbus in 1492. And it was a secret that the French crown was trying to protect. But unfortunately, the British crown knew about it. The Spanish knew about it. Yeah. And they were all duking it out to see who was going to control that great resource. We know that the Norse were you know, bringing back timber because their timber was scarce.
Yep.
They lived in a harsh landscape. They had to go to other lands to gain resources that they, you know, with if they were having a bad winter, crops failed.
Yeah.
There was a period where Europeans were actually being forced westward because of Mongol hordes were pushing people, you know, westward, the Visigoths, you name it, you know. So they were out looking for resources to take back home and survive. And they figured out a way to work with the Native Americans so that the Native Americans didn't get sick. You know, they bring the furs to the gate, they trade the European knights that were there, and these would have been low tier knights, junior noble members related to the crown. Now the name Rochefoucauld is at the top of Zena Halpern's map. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of junior members from the Roche family, distant cousins, who were going to that area for the pelts. France had nearly wiped out all their bears in around 600 AD. England, you know, the UK wiped out all their bears, exterminated them because they were using them for pelts, didn't think about the future. So, you know, they had to go get it from somewhere else.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't see the map you were showing. Let's see.
Excuse me.
What have you got there?
Norumbega, that is a Viking settlement in New England.
That is cool. Thank you for sharing that.
Not many people know that there is an entire forest in Maine called the King's Forest that is now marked land, like it's a national park. All that kind of stuff, but it is literally where the King of England got all of his straight timber for their tall ships.
Wow. Well, you know, the names are so important. Buildings might get wiped out. You know, I've been to many a town where there is no longer a Templar fortress because it's been taken down, stone used for something else.
Yeah.
It's been destroyed.
Very common practice back
then. And what you get is remaining are place names.
Yeah. Well, and you know, even one of the big mysteries of Templars, and especially their construction, was their use and color red, specifically the color red in their stained glass. And the article that I popped up a minute ago was literally talking about the technology and production of red window glass in the medieval period, and talking about how it is layered with copper nanoparticles.
No.
That is how the color red was attained by the Templars in their glass, was the use of copper.
I am so blown away. Thank you for that, Chris.
One more reason why they would have to have such a rich source and ready supply of that mineral.
Yes.
And even using it in tapestry, using the verdigris like we were talking about, in pigments for tapestries, everything else. All of this goes back to sacred spaces, goes back to their building of sacred spaces, not only as Cistercians, but as Templars.
Wonderful. You know, I honestly, I think if I ever have the opportunity to meet you, we would be talking for days until we dropped from exhaustion.
We've already talked for an hour before we recorded this.
I know. It was just absolutely wonderful as well. Just a wonderful conversation.
I love your research for this reason, because it literally touchstones on so many things. Because a lot of people get very caught up in the treasure history of the Templars, you know, the lost Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail. Was the Holy Grail a physical thing that caught the cup of Christ, caught the blood of Christ, or was it the bloodline of Christ through Mary Magdalene? What did they bring back? What they really brought back was the knowledge of these metals.
Yeah.
To use them in these ways.
You're not going to risk your life going to a strange land with,
in some hopes of finding a relic.
You could get killed. Not all the vessels that went to North America came back. You could be injured in a stupid accident, get sick. Not everybody made it back. And we know that from that marvelous Westford Knight carving, the Western Knight. But for me, I think it's a mistake to, I'm happy for the Ark to be there, the Grail to be there, the bloodline thing to be there, because all
not
of that's
denying any of it. Sure.
No, exactly. But if you want to get close to it, you got to chase down the detail. And if you don't acknowledge the capacity of the human beings' need for shelter, food, water, self-defense, organization, and being able to build and pass down a loved meditation practice.
Yeah.
Couched in Christ awareness, which is what their realm was. You've got to take care of the small print. So what I'm trying to do, what I choose to do, is as deep a dive as I can into the knowns, and to bring anomalous pieces of information together to form a broader picture. And today I just learned something new. You've just added another string to the bow and another reason as to why they risked their lives to go there.
Yeah.
To go to North America. And I do believe that a lot of the impetus, the legends, the founding fathers of America, as controversial as they have been recently, they did what they did. And I think it was an upgrade. And if you look at the Constitution, the thin end of the wedge is in there.
Yeah.
And later generations, Martin Luther King, suffragettes, all took advantage of that thin end of the wedge, which wasn't available in absolute monarchism across Europe.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate what happened with America, freedom of religion.
Yeah.
And I mean all religions. Be respectful of others, respect yourself, don't be an aggressor towards somebody else. And the rule of law is important.
Yeah.
Don't if you see somebody you don't like the way they dress, you don't like the way this, that, or other, just walk away.
Yeah.
Walk away.
Yeah.
And don't expect that individual to know who you are, what you do at home.
Or be vested. And be offended. Vested interest in it.
You know.
You're letting that rent a lot of spare space in your head if that's a vested interest in your life.
Exactly. I mean, it's getting ridiculous.
Yeah,
we all have better, mightier, higher things we can be attending to than some of the silly stuff going on. Anyway, forgive me.
But
if it gets to the point where you have to say things like, now I'm going to get in trouble for this. I respect you, my fellow being.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Absolutely.
Come on. And don't beat people up and don't be verbally abusive.
I say it on the show regularly and even in private life. The minute you remove choice of any kind, you have removed America.
Exactly.
Period.
Exactly.
That was a big, I think, point of enlightenment, that, just to loop it back, that the Templars came back with was the fact of there is a point of control here. And they I don't think that they would ever deny that being directly under the thumb of the Pope, not only as Cistercian monks, but as a military arm of the church as they were used. But once again, what changed things, I think, for them was the fact that, yes, they were monks. And especially when it came to the Cistercians, the big call of the Cistercians was ministry.
Yeah.
Going out to the world, being a mission. And one of the big things I bring up regularly is the way that monks changed history. And I mean changed history.
Yes.
Beowulf was not a written down story. Vikings didn't really write their stories down like that. They passed their stories along.
Yes.
So there's a lot of Christian influence to the story of Beowulf that we read.
Yes.
Even though it's a Viking story.
We might not be able to.
It was transcribed by them. They couldn't read and write.
No.
Three quarters to seven eighths of the public in medieval times, even the kings, could not read and write.
Exactly.
Monks read and wrote because they transcribed Bibles and things like that.
The Irish monks saved history and writing. Yeah. And we've lost 90% of our European secular and other documents. 90% of our culture in Europe is gone because those books got burned or destroyed by accident or on purpose.
Yep.
And if we didn't have the Irish monks were beautiful scholars. Now, we cannot impose upon them our mindset of today. It's impossible. We can't imagine what it must have been like at that time.
Well, but once again, their job was to mission. I was a Catholic seminarian. We did a whole lot of usurpation of local tradition. You got a festival at this Saturnalia. Hey, guess when Jesus was born? Christmas. Exactly. Hey, yeah, come on. We'll all have a party. We did it regularly. We did it regularly to assume local culture and create a holiday around it.
That's straight to Rome. I mean, that's what Rome did. And of course, the Catholic Church, stepped into the sandals of Rome. It truly did. And so all of the methods of civilization, Roman civilization the year 325, Constantine says, right, we're Christians now. Yeah. And so the Catholics as the centuries rolled forward, used the Roman grid system, the scholarship, the engineering, the math, the seven, they adopted the Greek seven liberal arts, you get the good with the bad and the feelings, the twinges of guilt with the good, but we can't change what happened. We can't.
No.
That's just as bad as burning books in itself.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't believe in revering oppressors or murderers.
No.
I don't believe in that whatsoever. And I don't believe in, I feel so badly for the indigenous culture of North America. They really do deserve of all the opportunities that can be handed out to them. They had a sophisticated culture without it being It didn't look like the European culture. They weren't building castles, but then very few people actually lived in castles. They were living in mud huts next to the castle.
Yeah, they were living in thatch huts, things like that. So,
you know, so it's been a wild conversation, Chris. I hope that I've covered all the bases.
Absolutely. You know, once again, just the fact of the Templars used code. They used alchemical symbols. They used alchemy to transmit this knowledge because it was a hidden system. It was a system of esotericism that very few people know, so it was a great way to be able to pass this knowledge along without it coming into the hands of the church. And once it comes into their hands, what do you do with that? Like, that it's just a bunch of symbols.
Exactly. And especially if it was obscured by being upside down or
in reverse,
slightly changed in reverse. Exactly. Yeah. And what's interesting, you know, the Templars had to, it was two in a room, you know, the Templar knights. Mm. They couldn't be alone. They slept with a candle on all night. That's in the rule book. And you had two brothers in a room, you know, and of course that's the rule, but we know that if you go to southern Spain, they allowed women to become Templars because they didn't have enough money. It was an impoverished area. And so you had female Templars. And they also adopted a slavery, unfortunately, as a way to get past the lack of money to be able to bring in skilled labor, whatever. Yeah. So, you know, you can't look at, okay, here's the rule book. This is what they did. And this is the only way it was. No, we're human beings and we're challenged by life. You know, currently we're being challenged by prices, you know, in the Western world, you know, hiking, you know, can we pay the, is it heat or eat? You know, so the same things that happen to us happen to other generations. So, what I was going to say is that, so you've got that 2x2 with the Templars, and it's even on their seal. Mm. Two Templars on horseback, and that's a thing in itself. But there is a legend that Bernard de Clairvaux's mother is related to the Counts of Toulouse, and the Counts of Toulouse protected the Cathars who preached 2x2. He went to Cathar country and preached to them, tried to bring them in closer alignment to the accepted external church, and they rode him out of town on a rail, as the old saying goes. And he wrote that they are more Christian than the Christians, and they need a great deal of talking to. So, of course, unfortunately, there's the symbol right there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, fast forward 100-something years, and the Albigensian Crusade took place, and they killed Raymond, the Count of Toulouse, and it was a rich, cultured area, an intelligent area, a learned area, and they, you know, tried to wipe out the Cathar heresy, didn't really succeed. It's still there. You can't kill ideas, especially if you come at it with a sword.
Yeah.
You just make people mad. And that's what's happened with the Templars. You know, you make people mad when you destroy a culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And what happens is ideas just go underground.
Absolutely. And then they come up when you can breathe the air again.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And I think that we are, and we have this conversation with a lot of guests, we are at a cusp. Even earlier today, before we had our conversation, talking about the harried way that the world is running right now. We are at a cusp of something. Things are boiling and roiling to the surface, and the surface tension's going to break. Something is happening about an awakening in humanity right now. And there is a huge return to spiritualism. There's a huge return to belief in paranormal, none of these things are new. These are all things that we have explored as humanity for a long time, and minds are opening, hearts are opening to it. So it's really interesting. And it's interesting, as we were saying before our conversation here on recording, how science is moving to that, how once again the whole concept of remote viewing is like scientifically sound.
I agree.
It's remarkable, and that's really the technology that and the knowledge that was the holy grail.
It's what we're built for. It's what we're built for. And that's why, you know, James Cameron created Avatar.
Yeah.
To be in sync with the beautiful natural world around us that we've been given, to take care of it, leave it in better shape for the next generation.
Yeah.
And to do the inner work, and that's part of what the seven liberal arts were about, is to create a human being with a good knowledge of the natural world. And that is a way of raising the spirituality of a person as well. That's it. Yes, and there it is.
And look at that. Astronomy. Astronomy. Straight up in the seven liberal arts. Because, yes, to understand your place in the cosmos, to understand the idea of being just a speck on the little blue speck in the universe, it puts your mind at a different level. And it prepares your mind for a spiritual journey that is different.
And I love the images of the James Webb Telescope. And when I see those images coming back at me, I'm in awe. And it makes me feel stronger. Mm-hmm. Look at all those universes out there. And that's only if it can be measured in understanding that we might have, as a grain of sand held at arm's length, you know, in between your finger and forefinger and thumb. And that isn't even all that's available out there. You know, if we can raise ourselves up and develop an inner balanced garden, we can have a greater capacity to reach out and discover what's out there. I mean, you know, to boldly go where no one has gone before, at least no Earthling has gone before.
You got to be willing to go. First, Gretchen, be willing to go.
And
your mind can learn great things if you give it the opportunity to learn them.
I think what's hard for people today is people as individuals need to be given the opportunity to find their why.
Yeah.
What do I want in life? And it's so difficult. Not everybody can be a famous singer, but you can be a magnificent singer in your family.
Sure.
It's using your gifts. You may have a job you don't like, and we've all been there.
Mm.
And I'm really blessed to be where I am at this time, researching full time, etc. But
it took a lot of work and manifestation for you to get there, though.
A lot of sacrifice, financial sacrifice. I live thousands of miles away from my family, blah, 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 on and on. You know, it everything has a cost.
Well,
Nothing is for free. And that's where this physical world comes in. We have to respect our body, what the body needs, our environment needs. And I mean, you know, keep your house clean so that your mind can be free to have bigger thoughts. Respect yourself. Don't dwell on what people are doing when you're out and around and see somebody who's a bit weird at the grocery store. You know, don't get in their face. And if somebody gets in your face, that's a matter of law. And that's when you need to reach out to law enforcement if it calls for that. But it's about developing a human inner garden with multiple capacities, or at least an understanding. I mean, some of us are better at other things, but it's also a spiritual understanding. And my first book covers a lot of ground. It covers the seven liberal arts. Yeah. It covers Christian mystic women who were very deeply entrenched in learning. So, you know, it's as you said, Catholicism did save the past when they started writing stuff down. And they looked at it from their point of view.
Oh, absolutely.
But nevertheless, and they did it.
Yeah, know? Yeah. They converted a lot of things to their point of view. They, you know, but they did quite a bit as far as, you know, going out and recording things.
And that's that human nature.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's just human nature to, and people with very deeply held beliefs that they're in love with, if they're confronted by somebody who says, no, you're wrong.
Yeah.
You know, they've just stepped all over your belief system.
We deal with it in this society right now all the time. The rampant idea of, confirmation bias, the idea of not being able to accept data and just accept accepting a point of datum and putting it into your set of data. You don't have to get passionate about it. It doesn't have to break your paradigm. A lot of people get upset with me sometimes because I'm a believer. Don't get me wrong, Gretchen, but my job is to be a skeptic. And proper skepticism means that you are willing to have your mind changed.
Yes.
And people forget that. People think that skeptics are there to destroy everything. And no. I am there to get rid of the known quantitative and leave the anomalous. Now let's look at the, and now all we got left is the anomaly. We got rid of all the everyday stuff it could be. Now we're left with this, and there's a 2%. Yeah. And I say it on the show all the time. I don't know a carpenter that would leave 2% of a wall unbuilt. I don't know of a chemistry person, a chemist out there that if missing 2% of a solution at the end of a reaction would be like, well, that's gone.
Well, you know what I like about
the equation isn't complete if you don't have the 2%.
Yeah, as an organization, the Catholic Church has some problems. And I saw a documentary that really helped me understand a great deal. Mm. The Pope is in charge of a multi-international group of other orders and other churches. It's filled with different Catholic denominations. And he can't just press a big button, you know, at his desk.
Oh, yeah.
And everything's going to happen. Nope. In fact, it's impossible. What he can do is lead. And he's even started saying, you know, priests should be married. And, you know, they're having a hard time in South America finding priests. So he's thinking, well, maybe
having
we need
a hard time all over the world.
Yeah.
Finding
and in all honesty, you know, the early church
That didn't come around till the Visigoths.
You know, and
celibacy amongst priesthood didn't happen until the fact that it became an issue that, hey, you know what's funny? And pardon the actual proper use of the term here, but you know what's funny is this bastard down the road is saying that the padre who just died is his father and now he has some claim to church property.
That's a really good point. And what I appreciate is that the Catholic Church has a fantastic science department. They their own observatory.
Yeah.
You know, they are up on the science.
They definitely muscled their way into a mountaintop in Arizona. That was really wild.
That's incredible.
They just things moved for them.
There's a real spirituality.
But they are the world's oldest political organization.
Agreed.
They are the oldest continually running government. And yeah, like you said, as opposed to a lot of religious leaders, unless it is good for the entire Catholics, universal. Unless it's good for every part of the body of the church, the change will not occur.
I agree with you.
That's just the way it works. They can't pass it because it works in America.
It
has to work for the world or it doesn't change.
Exactly. And as an individual that had loves of, you know, I love this about that subject. I love this about that subject. I am emotionally invested in this topic. I've had some moments where I've thought, oh my God, I have to check myself and I have to make a change because I found out more and it doesn't add up anymore.
Yeah.
And when that moment hits, you know, believe you me, it feels bad.
It can.
It feels bad, you know, and then
it's
there's
paradigm
the
shaking.
I've discovered this and I am so excited that I'm probably insufferable to be around, you know, for a while. But
you're trying to make other people realize.
It's like being an engineer and your spouse doesn't know what an engineer does when you, you know. but
it's like, you know, my wife.
Yeah, it's not an easy.
I've said numerous times, my job is to make sure that she has the burden of figuring out what all this equipment does when it comes time to sell it after I'm gone.
I hear you.
But in all sincerity, it really is the journey of the Templars is the journey of knowledge. It is the journey of science. It is the journey of carrying knowledge from one culture and bringing it about to the world.
Yes.
They did that through their knowledge of metallurgy, through their knowledge of, once again, even the red glass that they put up in every church they built, that until recently we didn't even know what we could not replicate. It could not be replicated by modern glass techniques until they found out that, it was nano flakes of copper, things like that, that refracted the light just properly. They had incredible knowledge on this. And it's because that is what their quest was.
And it's all about creating an awe-inspiring moment.
Yeah.
You know, when they had a hand in building churches and the Cistercians, and creating glass for churches.
Yeah.
You know, when I walked into Gloucester Cathedral, it's breathtaking.
Yeah.
It's lifting. And the powerful yet delicate looking tracery stonework is, you wonder, how did they do that? And you just keep looking up going, and you're small in this gigantic space.
Yeah.
And you just look up in wonderment. And after you're finished with the weekly service, you go home to your mud hut that's resting against the city wall.
it truly is creating that moment of connection with the divine.
It is. And it's a beautiful heritage.
It's amazing what
Europe
they were able to
developed.
Preserve.
It's a beautiful heritage to partake in.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your continued research into this stuff, especially the Templar connection with alchemy, things like that. Absolutely awesome. Let everybody know, Gretchen, where they can go to pick up their copy of your book, The Secret Dossier of a Knight Templar of the Sangreal, as well as Oak Islands and Stars of Mary Magdalene. Where can they go to keep track of everything that you do?
I appreciate that. My website is literally my name, GretchenCornwall.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm on YouTube. But you can buy a signed copy on my website. It is a little bit expensive, but everything has gotten expensive. All three of my books are full of color images and maps. Each book that I have out right now has no less than 150 color images in them and maps.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty tall order for any book. And also it's on photography paper so that the images don't bleed through to the next page, etc. But I do have signed copies available. My latest book is the it covers quite a lot of ground. It's Oak Island's Mysteries of the Map, House of Rochefoucauld, Templar Statue, and Royston Cave. There it is. That's my latest book. And this is the culmination of my research at Royston Cave,
yeah.
Zena Halpern's map, Oak Island to date. And the reason why Oak Island called me and said, hey, can you give us a tour of Royston Cave?
Yeah.
And they gave me just a brief, you know, we were down there for maybe 3 or 4 hours. And there were quite a few links to Rochefoucauld, Zena Halpern, Templars, and Oak Island that didn't even make it to the TV show, to the program. But they can't fit everything in. And I was thrilled to have been brought in to the season premiere. It was a privilege. It really was. And meeting Marty Lagina, Charles Barkhouse, and Alex Lagina, all three gentlemen. And I had a few awkward moments in front of the camera, which they helped me with, which I appreciated.
That's
and
nice.
It was just a fantastic experience overall. And I hope I have another experience of filming with them.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're just a professional, very professional film company.
Wow.
And they treat their guests very, very well, you
Fantastic.
Know. So it was a good experience. But, you know, it's people do complain about it. You know, why didn't they discover the treasure yet? I'm tired of seeing wood. But it's about accumulating evidence in order to understand what happened on a timeline.
That's right.
And it's that work that leads you to the treasure. And I really am beginning to think that there is treasure there, but not in the money pit. I think that's a sacred treasure in the money pit. Mm. What condition it's in now, if it's still there, I don't know, but they're finding traces in the water of gold and silver, high concentrations.
Good quantity traces.
Good quality. Yeah. I mean, we're talking treasure.
Beyond normal trace amount.
Yeah, it's something important melted down there into the water. But if you're talking spendable treasure like copper, silver, you know, the need for saltpeter, a component in gunpowder, verdigris. You're talking spendable treasure that might have needed to have been buried on the island.
Can be used for curing meats, all kinds of things.
Yeah, and, you know, the things you need for warcraft, for art. Copper is an important component in roofing for cathedrals.
Yeah.
And so was lead. There's been a problem over here in the last decade or two of people stealing, getting up on top of heritage buildings, stealing
the copper plate
or
roofing.
Lead roofing, and when they can't replace it, it's too expensive.
Yep.
So, you know, that spendable treasure that would have been buried somewhere else where they could get at it without killing themselves and their men and haul it back at an appropriate time, to Norway, Northern Scotland, the Orkney Islands, Shetland Islands, etc., or other Templar holdings, you know, etc.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Awesome.
Be careful.
Yeah.
I'll keep talking if you let me.
That's all right. I love it. thank you so much, as always, Gretchen. It's always awesome having you on the show. I love catching up with you and your research and just having these conversations. We always go somewhere, and there's always some new revelations that happen during them. So,
yes, and I couldn't believe your timing on the heels of literally what took place in just the last, month.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
amazing information. I cannot wait.
Anyone else, you know, really didn't know where I was going to go with it next other than put a proposal together to the producers of Oak Island and introduce them to this content.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, really a pleasure to speak with you. Take care of yourself.
You bet.
Be happy.
Well, hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. Of course, while you are online, checking out all of the amazing work of Gretchen Cornwall over at GretchenCornwall.com, as well as her YouTube channel, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can find all of the video channels of our guests. We embed them right there so you can have easy, quick access to all of their stuff. You don't have to go searching for it, folks. Literally hop on by CuriousRealm.com/videos and scroll down. You will find the content from Gretchen Cornwall embedded right there. You can watch it all right there on our website. While you're there, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com/store. Pick up your copies of Gretchen's books as well as books from our other guests. Take care of yourselves, folks. Take care of each other. It's a crazy world out there right now, and once again, it's all coming to a head and roiling to something. So take care of each other, all right? Make sure to stay curious. We'll talk to you soon, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.